This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
All right, welcome back to the fourth installment of our Winter 2015 UC Santa Barbara Distinguished Speaker Series. I'm John Greathouse. You can follow me on Twitter, at John Greathouse. I will never tweet about sunsets, kittens, or rainbows, I promise you. I've been teaching here so long, this is my ninth year at UC Santa Barbara, that I actually have students that have gone on and been successful in business. So it's wonderful as a teacher to see these folks that were young, many in this audience here, young, inexperienced students. They go through our technology management program here at UC Santa Barbara, and instead of opting for a job at a startup or a job at a established company, they actually go off and start their own venture. All the gentlemen on the stage with us today started their companies right out of the university. So we'll start today with Anthony Martin. Anthony is here with us. He actually had started another business in his dorm room while he was here at UC Santa Barbara. And then in 2010, he started what became iCracked. He actually teamed up with A.J. Forsyth, who was at San Luis Obispo. So this is a Cal Poly UCSB success story that we will gladly share with them. In 2011, Anthony and A.J. took the plunge. They moved to Silicon Valley. They joined the accelerator program with Y Combinator, and they graduated there in 2012. They now have a community of over 1,600 certified iTechs across the country, as well as in 11 other countries. And they are the world's largest and most efficient on-demand repair and trade-in network for iOS devices. If your phone, if your iPhone or your iPad get broken, these are the guys that can help you fix them at iCracked. Let's give Anthony a warm welcome. Rod Mobram is also here with us. Rod is the co-founder and CEO of Lettuce. He's already a two-time entrepreneur. What are you guys waiting for? Rod sold his first company that he started right out of school, and that company actually led to the company called Lettuce, which last year was purchased by Intuit for $30 million. Rod has many strengths, as I saw when he was a student in my class. In his companies, he's been focusing on product, on growth, and on building the great team that he's put around him. He's actually stayed with Intuit now, and he's leading QuickBooks' OS, which is the next generation operating system for small to medium-sized businesses. Let's give Rod a hand. All right, next up we have Chris Herbert, who is the CEO and co-founder of Tracker. Chris focuses on product strategy and marketing. He got his degree from electrical engineering here from UC Santa Barbara. And with him is Christian Smith, who is the president and co-founder of Tracker. They had the original idea in 2008 in my fall entrepreneurship class, and they originally were focused on tracking cell phones. They seem to have, both of them had problems losing things throughout their UC Santa Barbara career. Keys, I remember surfing, and I think somebody forgot their wallet at dinner, which I'm sure wasn't on purpose. No one's ever done that before. Anyway, that was their excuse for starting what was originally called Phone Halo, and it was tracking your cell phone. Many years later, many months, many trials and tribulations later, over 400,000 devices sold later, they are now tracking thousands of devices, and they've modified the name of their company to Tracker to more accurately describe the fact that they can track pretty much anything. They are tracking so many things that every minute they help 80 users find a lost item all over the world. It's quite a story. They bootstrapped as well as raised $1 million from corporate venture financing, and they become a leader in what's called the Internet of Things. So they were one of the first companies to start connecting devices to the Internet that wouldn't normally be associated with the Internet. So inanimate objects that aren't computers, they aren't cell phones, they aren't smartphones, those things are now being tracked and tied to the Internet. And thanks in part to Chris and Christian's hard work. Let's welcome them as well. Well, it really is fun for me to get and sit down with you guys after all these years. I've seen most of you, you know, off and on throughout the years, but it's fun to have you up here. And I was asking before if they thought they would be up on this stage, and kind of got a mixed review. All of them are quite happy, though, to be up here, but not quite as happy as me, because I know how hard it is to take time out. You guys travel down from the Bay Area. I really appreciate that. It's super hard to take time for this sort of thing, so it's a way for them to give back to the community and show their respect to UC Santa Barbara. So I'm appreciative of that, guys.
Thanks for having us.
So let me start with, since my frame of reference for you guys is as students, what was it? So I try to tell you guys what I think it's going to be like and all the things I went through back in the dark ages. So now that you've actually gone out, had success, I just love to hear your quick thoughts on, were there any misconceptions of the startup world that once you got out there, you thought, wow, this isn't at all what I thought I was going to be up to? Now we'll just go down the line if you want.
Yeah, I mean, I think kind of like sitting in your shoes right now, you get to hear a lot of great stories about companies started and kind of hear from John exactly how he had built his companies in the past. And it would just seem like this thing that was out of reach more so than anything. But hearing these stories, you start to try and put yourself in your shoes. If I was there, how it would feel. And you get that from that perspective, being in this classroom. But really, it's like once you're out into the real world, you have to live it. And what I think I realized mostly is, you know, startups aren't as glamorous as everyone believes they actually are. Like, you hear the headlines, you hear a lot of things about, oh, this company raised this, this company did that, this company got bought for $30 million. And I can tell you, I think one of our jobs is to explain that, you know, it's not that way, and it takes a lot of hard work, but it's really inspiring to hear from people like John when we're in your shoes, that journey. So.
And I do try to make it clear that it is a lot of hard work, that it's not a rational decision.
Right.
But it's very glamorous, right? We've had a lot of movies. This society certainly likes to celebrate our entrepreneurs, and there's nothing wrong with that. But you're right. Day in and day out, it's hard. It's super hard work.
It's hard to know until you actually just do it.
Right. You read about it, but then when you have to experience it firsthand, it's different.
Right.
Did you have any thoughts in that regard? Like, what didn't I tell you that I should have?
Nothing that on paper, it seems like on paper, like when you write down, like, oh, that's going to work, actually worked. And like the stories that we heard from like your startup experience were, you know, we heard like more broad things, not so much detailed. And so it was just incredible about like how many things just didn't work and how you had to just kind of iterate and iterate and iterate and basically like keep doing it until finally like one thing worked. And that's the thing. So like the one thing that I wish I had known going into it was that like if you have perseverance and you're working smart, that you'll probably find success some of the times. If that makes sense. I don't know. Basically it was just so hard, and it just, had I known if you keep trying and keep trying and are doing something smart, that you'll most likely achieve some sort of success.
Yeah, and I think all of you share that. I mean, it's from the outside looking in, it always looks easy and quick and, you know, unbelievably wondrous. But then I know the tracker guys can attest to the fact that you had a lot of ups and downs. There was a lot of times where you weren't sure the right direction, you weren't sure where the next fundraising was going to come from. And that's hard to teach in a classroom. Like, I can tell you that, but until you really experience it, it's tough. Were there other things that you guys experienced that you know, you wish I had told you, or that just were surprises?
I think the number one thing that I learned along the way and through all of our ups and downs and being wrong most of the time is that there isn't that golden bullet. That isn't that one event that, oh, it was this one product release, or it was this one marketing campaign, this one steal, and then suddenly it's all good. And I think the tech press and a lot of what you hear in news and movies is it's this one thing that was done right and then bam, it exploded.
Right.
It's a lot of just small iterations, persistence in getting it done.
Yeah, well, that's how they have to move the plot along in a movie. Like, I love the Facebook movie where somebody's like, dude, it's not like people have a bubble over their head talking about their status, and then the guy runs to his dorm room and they do a video montage of him like typing. Like, God, wouldn't it be nice if it was that that easy.
Yeah.
It's never quite that easy.
I wish my start was in video.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I learned, you know, in the classroom versus the real world is the mindset and the attitude that you have to carry with you on a daily basis. And investing in that mindset, it is like a moment-by-moment battle. And if you can win that battle, then you can tip the scale of success in your favor. And so by having a good attitude, by, you know, showing up and, you know, giving your all, whether it's, you know, writing a single sentence or, you know, writing an email or, you know, just doing someone a favor, like showing up with a fantastic attitude where you're, you know, willing to work your hardest all the time is a habit that you develop. And that habit leads to success eventually. But, you know, that's not something that you can't, it's not a muscle that you can work out in a classroom. You have to be, you know, on the corporate battlefield every day, like, you know, making that happen.
Yep, no, I agree. I'm going to have Chris answer this one so we don't just go back and forth like like a tennis match. So a lot of these folks in this classroom are seniors, some are juniors, people watching all over the world are in various stages of their life. Do you have advice specific to this group? If you could go back to your senior year, what would you have done differently? What do you wish you had done? What are things, skills you wish you had now that you just didn't take the time to hone? Any of the above?
I really think that the number, if I could go back my senior year and if I could do one thing, I would get really good at design. It just, I would get really good at Photoshop, taking photos and website design. I would like seriously take a one unit class, extra crash a class. I know there's free classes on Photoshop. Get good at Photoshop. It's easy and can really add to the experience.
So be that person in your group, if it's a group project, that takes on the design mantle, that actually works on that part of the project. And I would say, you know, just expounding on that, do that in general. Like, if you're really good at something, don't do that in your next group project. Like, try to pick something else. Pick marketing, pick sales, something you're not good at or haven't done much of. Because this is the best place to do it. Like, I mean, it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. You're here to learn, not to, you know, always get the A+. Do you guys have any other thoughts, anything senior year type stuff that you would... that wish you had done or advice you'd want to give?
I wouldn't have changed anything, honestly.
Oh, come on.
No, I had a great senior. I mean, like, the thing is, like, I wouldn't be where I am if I hadn't done all the things I did my senior year and then the years after that. And
what are some things you did in your senior year you think that had a direct impact?
The biggest impact of college for me, honestly, was the social aspect. I went to parties. I had a lot of fun. I worked my butt off because I did mechanical engineering. But the main thing was I went to these social settings and I just, you know, live life. And the fact is there's so many events in business that you just have to be social and you kind of have to be not the life of the party, but you have to kind of be some sunshine in that party or some light in that party, something that's noticeable. And that's what I learned. Like, UCSB is known for that. And the fact that I was able to be comfortable in settings like that and just be a normal college student, that was actually one of the greatest benefits of coming to a school like this. And that taught me a lot going into the future about how to just be a normal person. Because when you're doing business with other human beings.
Right. So develop some social skills.
Totally.
Be able to hold a conversation.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
I was super shy in high school. And the fact that I came to this college.
I can't imagine you shy. That's
so
a lie.
Shy. Very
that
shy.
That is a lie.
Yeah. It taught me a lot.
Did you want to add anything or...
Just to touch on both of those, I mean, two of the points that they brought up, I mean, design is very important when you're searching for a product, because a lot of, like, once you start a company, it's like you're it's like falling out of, like, especially if you raise money, it's like falling out of a plane and trying to assemble something before you hit the ground and run out
of
money.
Come on, I talk about that in class. You stole that from me.
I stole that from, okay.
Base jumping. That's
right. Yeah.
I stole it from somebody, don't worry.
It feels a lot like that. Yeah, and I think, you know, that's a lot of how that saying circulates around because it really strikes home to a lot of people. So if you can rapid prototype your product and get some sort of conceptual idea on how the consumer is going to interface with that, and then be able to build a team to help, like, really allow them to visualize what needs to be built. That's very helpful. And then what I didn't realize either is, look, we're all very privileged to go to UCSB because it is a very social atmosphere, and you should take advantage of that. I didn't realize how important networking out in the real world in business was and how important that was. Now, there's a balance between that, right? You can't just go to conventions and just, you know, neglect, you know, the product. But so I think those two things are very important to be able to really take off in the beginning.
Yep.
But as far as college experience, I'd say I was happy I quit baseball when I did. it's a very time-consuming thing, and you know those skill sets. The only thing that translates is competitive is the competitive skill sets. But being able to take those and move it into something that had more legs than when your arm, you know, finally gives out was the biggest thing for me, I'd say.
So I think you went from one of the statistics I love to spout, and I do believe it's still true, that there you have a better chance of playing professional baseball than you do to becoming a venture capitalist. There's actually fewer venture capitalists than there are professional baseball players. Mm-hmm. I think there's probably the same to say about being a successful entrepreneur at your level, at a tech level. You probably have a better chance of being a professional baseball player than you do from getting into Y Combinator, raising venture money, getting 400,000 customers. Very few people actually get that done.
Totally.
So let's talk about fundraising. All of you have raised money. You've raised it in different ways. Two of you have gone through accelerators. I didn't mention that Rod went through the
Launchpad.
Yeah, Launchpad LA. Sorry. That's my own launch. I'm affiliated with it, and I couldn't remember. We'll edit that out. And you guys didn't. So I'd just like to hear a little bit about fundraising. I know you guys did it all different ways. And any thoughts you might have on an accelerator or you know, whether you had wished you had gone to one or whatever. And any thoughts you guys have, just kick it off, Rod.
Yeah, I mean, especially your experience level and your age, I would highly recommend going through an accelerator. One, you're going to get a lot of education on how to do things in terms of growth, marketing, product. And two, it's all about networking. And I could have done what I did without Launchpad, but it would have taken me 2 years. And basically what Launchpad did was there was investors that came into the door every day. And so we would meet with them. And if they thought it was interesting, we would talk more and kind of keep in touch. And when we went to fundraise, it was the first round, first time was like a 3-4 month process. And we were able to get a pretty good deal. So I highly recommend it.
Yep. And no matter what anybody says, it's never easy to fundraise. Sometimes it's just a little easier than other times.
Yeah. It's still really
easy.
Hard. I went through some emotional moments and during that 3-4 months.
Yeah, it's tough.
Full beard.
You looked almost 30. It was crazy.
It was weird.
Do you guys want to talk a little bit about you bootstrapped, and then you guys ended up raising some substantial money?
Yeah, so we started out just with the mentality that sales is going to solve all problems. And we executed on that, got a few publicly traded companies to license our product to kind of get us along in the early days. And we closed a deal with Verizon Wireless, and we're distributing in all of their stores. And we actually used that leverage to get into what's called Orange Fab. Orange is a French telecom company. And so in 2013, we did their accelerator program. And we wouldn't be where we are today without Orange Fab. They gave us, you know, a little bit of capital, but the biggest thing was access to, like, top-tier mentors. And I actually saw one of the mentors a few weeks ago, and I just thanked him so much for what he had shared, because he was talking about, you know, business development and, you know, some of the strategies and skills that you can develop over time to sell. And I was just letting him know I was, you know, finally stepping into the place where I was able to leverage a lot of the skills and master some of the skills that he was talking about in sales. So we're, you know, talking with major retailers, and I was telling Mark that he does business development for Clover. And I was saying, Mark, you know, thank you so much, because now when I'm meeting with these big retailers, I feel like the tables are turned in my favor. And, you know, I can leverage a lot of the skills that you talked about. So, you know, just in terms of personal mentorship and kind of corporate mentorship, it's huge.
The bootstrapping is not sexy at all. When we first got started, we did bootstrap. It is not a pleasant experience. You know that myth of doing a startup in the garage? garage, they're cold and they're filled with insects. And you are just like, you have just a short fuse. We each lost like 15 pounds.
I gained 15 pounds. So.
Yeah. Do an accelerator. It's a lot better path.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you touched upon mentors and the fact that you went back later and thanked your mentor. So you had the wherewithal, all of you guys, to find mentors. And then it's obviously great when you can go back and say, hey, you know, that stuff you told me, I actually put it to use. That's what mentors get paid in. They get paid in those psychic rewards. So good for you. Mm-hmm. Any comments on fundraising? But you guys went through the accelerator. You came out of there. You had a little bit of funding. Then what happened?
Well, I'll touch base on Y Combinator first, and then we can talk about what happened after. But, I mean, for us going through Y Combinator, it was one, first of all, we never thought we'd get in. It happened when we were working in Sunnyvale. We moved up north. We finally got a place to work out of. Before, we moved up with no place, and we're living on AJ's brother's couch for two months or so.
It's glamorous. Come on.
It's great. And it was, we never told him how long we were going to stay because we didn't know. And then it was one of those times where, you know, his roommates were like, hey, Chip, when's your brother and his friend leaving the couch? So we definitely outwarmed our welcome. But you got to be scrappy, right? So we hadn't really raised any money at that point. And we heard that, we knew we wanted to be in an incubator. Basically saw on TechCrunch that Y Combinator was getting an application a minute, and we're like, I was like, hey, AJ, like, we're sitting, we didn't even have chairs, we were sitting on these, like, these little boxes that had all of our inventory in it, and, like, you can fit all of our inventory in two boxes that we sat on, and would just type away all day. So I was like, AJ, hey, there's, they're getting an application a minute, maybe we should apply. So we apply, and if anyone knows anything about Y Combinator, it's not your non-technical founders that typically get in. And so we did a whole application, threw a video together, and kind of forgot about it. And we actually ended up getting in. And there's a cool story about that that one day I'll tell you. But as far as Y Combinator goes, I think it's a huge catalyst and a very good thing for a couple of reasons, any incubator you get in. So first of all, it validates your idea. And especially with friends, family, what have you, all of a sudden it's like, okay, there's this startup community that says, hey, what you're working on is actually not just some crazy thing. But most of the time it's still an idea or you have some traction. And the other piece to it is now you have 10 weeks where it's socially acceptable to close yourself off from the world, only focus on users, focus on your product, and work with this network of people that are doing exactly the same thing. And so it really trains you really quickly within 10 weeks on how to just only focus on your business. And then by the time you're done, you've built these habits. And I think it's a great way to accelerate how quickly you're going to really catapult your company.
That's very.
So you came out, and then how did that funding go down? So you got a little bit of money coming out.
Yeah, we got some money in an angel round after Y Combinator. And then we just continued scaling. Basically from there.
Okay.
So we've never announced or raised any real capital after that.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that. Mm-hmm. So we'll get to the next student question in 1 second. So PR. So PR can tie into fundraising. I think all of you guys have had some pretty incredible outsized PR for the size of your ventures. Any thoughts you want to share on young entrepreneurs trying to get PR? Because you have that angle, right?
Yep.
You have that angle. Young, right out of school, first-time founder. People like to write about that. Mm-hmm. We all love those stories. So you have to play the angles. Tell us a little bit about the different PR. I'll start with you guys at the end. The different PR you've gotten, because I know it's been pretty impressive. And you got some really early on.
Yeah, I would say early on, I remember being at CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, which is, you know, the biggest trade show for our industry. And this, you know, lady walked up and asked me about, you know, what was happening, you know, what we were doing, and, you know, told her everything, right? She's like writing, taking a bunch of notes, and turns out she's a Wall Street Journal reporter. Ended up posting, you know, this is one of the coolest things that I saw at CES. And it was, you know, a really fantastic piece, but just being yourself and really clearly communicating what you're doing, distilling that down into like benefits so that, you know, a reporter can take that. And also, you know, having a clear story of why you're doing what you're doing, I think is, you know, what they love to hear. all reporters are kind of looking for that, you know, who's the next, you know, Steve Jobs or Bill Gates.
Yeah, I think you touched on something really important. You have to help them write the story. Yep. Like, if you don't take the time to help frame the story for them, they may not take the time themselves. So you don't literally write the story, but you help shape that story
I
for them.
I wrote the story for
I've
them.
I've done that too. But I have written stories that ended up getting published. But you don't always have to literally do that. But you do have to shape it. You can't just say, hey, we're cool, and here's what's cool about us, and expect them to go off and do heavy lifting. Mm. Most people won't.
Yeah.
So talk about PR a little bit. You wrote some stories.
Yeah, I mean, everything I did, I wanted to make it incredibly easy for everyone. And related to PR, I would just write articles for them and send it to them after getting a really good warm introduction or meeting them and kind of befriending these journalists. And so I would write these pieces and like, hey, here's a piece. Tweak it however you want, if you want to use it, or if you want to write it on your own. Here's a good foundation. And so some use those word for word, and some others wrote their story entirely based off this one article I wrote and also a couple interviews. And so I just made it really easy for the journalists because they're getting pitched all the time. And if you can make their jobs easy of getting a piece out, you'll have a higher chance of success as a result of that.
So I always say that you should do PR yourself when you're in the early stages because it's just, you know, you're the one that can tell the story. Like your example at CES, yeah. If you'd had a PR firm at that point, they would not have been able to tell your story.
No.
Have you guys picked, did any of you pick up a PR firm? Is that a path you went?
Later.
Yeah, so later it can make sense. Mm-hmm. Like, once your story's baked and you sort of understand what it is. And
mm-hmm. Like it's the same thing with like if you look at every department of your company, like if you haven't done the marketing first, like you're not going to be able to tell your marketer how to market your product. To understand, for example, I used to pitch the product, and my pitch changed so many times that finally I honed in on a really good pitch that people understood. It was really quick. And I'm like, okay, now we're going to base our marketing messages off that pitch.
Right.
My sales department, like, which wasn't that many salespeople, but my sales, like I had to do the sales, fine-tune the sales process so then I can repeat that and teach my salespeople because they're not going to know. They're not pros in what we're doing. We're hiring them, and they can learn as much as they can, but we have to really train them well. And so everything you do, you got to kind of do yourself first. And then make it repeatable so that you can teach whoever you're hiring to do that.
Yep. Any PR stories, any tips, tricks?
Yeah, I mean, that's not something you can outsource. It has to come from the message from the founders, and it takes a lot of time to, like you said, iterate and reiterate what's actually ringing true with both the media and consumers. And so, I mean, that's a big, big role as a founder to be able to deliver those messages. And then, you know, we've also used PR firms, but that's later stage. I would highly recommend not to do that. If you're starting your company, I mean, just get a list of people and networks that know people in press and just email them, get in front of them, keep on showing them iterations of your product and how, hey, this is our overall vision, and then just keep tabs with them throughout the whole time. So they're basically exploring that journey with you. And one of them will fall, right? It's a numbers game. And I think it's like, as long as you can just build those relationships early on, it's much easier to get an article written about you later down the road. And once you get that first one, that's probably the hardest one, I'd say, you know, and that just, you leverage that into the next article. And keep on leveraging those as much as possible. When you're hot, you're hot. And when you're not, you're not. And so if you get one, try and use that as much as possible with the networks that you've been working on and showing these iterations of your product.
Yep, good advice.
And become friends with them. Honestly, like in anything, if you become friends with like anyone that does anything, they're more like hooking you up as a friend than being annoyed and being like, okay, yeah. I guess I have to write this for
that's
you.
Right.
Like when
right.
you have your friend, if he's writing for Washington Post or something, I'm like, hey, write this piece. He's like, yeah, totally, no problem. You know, friends in different places really help out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't be afraid to bro up. You guys remember that from
bro
class?
Up.
Right? Bro up.
Bro up, man.
You gotta bro. I use that all the time.
Well, that works for men and women.
Yeah.
So we'll take the first question from the students. I'll repeat it.
All right, thank you all for coming. This question is specifically for Anthony, though.
Mm-hmm.
I see that iCracked has expanded to some foreign markets, including the UK. What is your strategy in terms of competing with other Apple repair companies such as iMend, a similar service to iProduct? How do you plan to attract and market yourselves to customers when there is already a well-established alternative?
So I appreciate that you spoke up loudly, but I'm just going to paraphrase it just in case people that are watching this didn't hear it all. So you guys have competitors in the UK. You're yep. expanding to the UK. Mm-hmm. What are you guys going to do to differentiate yourselves from folks that are already there?
Sure. Yeah, so for those of you that don't know, we just launched our office in London a couple months ago. We now have about 60 iTechs in the area, and we're building demand for the product. And when I look, you know, if you look at the competitive landscape, I'd say for what is iPhone repair or just any iOS device, we're basically agnostic to what we're fixing. But if you look at that landscape, you're going to fall into companies like iMend and a lot of like mom and pop shops that are basically servicing a decent amount of the market. And there's different tiers to the market, right? You have people that are going to want like your cheapest repair that's going to take, you know, that they're willing to drive somewhere and take an hour out of their day.
That's me.
To be able to do that. Yeah. And then what we're going after is more of a higher end, time conscious people that are willing to pay a premium for service. And I think those are two very different customers. So we're not trying to go after the same type of customers. We're trying to increase the experience and the convenience for the customers that are using our service. Now, and when I look at that, you know, our job is to not just fix iPhones, right? The goal of iCracked isn't like, I think at surface level, you'll say, hey, that's an iPhone repair company. Our goal is to manage the complete life cycle of these devices from buying it, repairing it, selling them, protecting them, and the whole life cycle from when you guys get new upgrades to the airtime, and then also interacting with that device everywhere. So we have some ambitious goals on how that will work. iMend and companies like that happen to be one part of the segment that we're going after. But I also look at companies like that as people like, you know, here's a good example. You have Uber, right, that started in the high-end market that, you know, they were driving black cars and using the access bandwidth of professional drivers. And then as they wanted to go after different markets, now they've launched UberX, right, which is more so your consumer end that, you know, if I have a car, I can start driving it right away. And those two customers that use either Uber or UberX are much different. And I think we can help people like your repair shops doing this, and it's just a different part of the market that will end up helping them make more money one day.
So know your market, know your market segment, know where you play in the market, and have a second act. Like, know what you're going to do once you build on that first act. All
right.
Super important things. And I've used iCracked. I am cheap, but I did use iCracked. It's a great service.
We fixed your iPad, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, somebody
awesome.
Dropped it in the hot tub. Oh, that was me. My wife thought it was so funny. So I've got a question. I've got the next question, then we'll get another one from the students. So pivots are over talked about, I think, too much in business. Pivots are basically when you iterate and make a change in your business model. But we have good examples up here of pivots of a sort. So, Rod, I wouldn't say your businesses were necessarily pivots, but one led to another.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us quickly about the first company and then how that led to Lettuce, which ended up being your latest success?
Totally. So the first company I started was a dog toy company, and we had big ambitions.
Dog toy company.
Dog toys. Drop the mic. That's what's up. So dog toy company, and it was called Durable Ideas because we had ambitions to kind of create like the next IDEO. That was my dream. But it was dog toys at the moment. And we were getting all these orders, and we were growing that company pretty rapidly for a self-funded business. And we saw a huge problem in how we were capturing our orders, tracking those orders, fulfilling those orders. And basically, we had all these different systems that we used for each different function of this order process. So you had accounting, credit card processing, shipping, you had inventory, customer management, and none of these different systems talk to each other. So we looked at finding an outside solution like NetSuite, SAP, Oracle that would kind of provide these really robust systems that basically built these systems that connected already together. But one, we couldn't afford it. Two, they weren't the greatest of products, especially for a company our size, or especially for someone like our age, our generation, where we actually really admire a good design. And so we decided to build this in-house system just for us. And it was wonderful. It was mobile, it was web-based. So picture this, we're at a wholesale trade show. Instead of writing orders on paper order forms, we were taking it on an iPad, and then it would sync to our cloud-based solution, which then connected into all of our different components, and just like literally with one click of a button, process the entire order. So we changed this like 1 hour per order process into literally like milliseconds. And it was awesome. The sound of like us clicking that button, hearing like all these printers go off, and like it was like I don't know, whatever, like Willy
Magic.
Wonka. Yeah, Willy Wonka land. And so everybody saw us using this iPad, taking orders at these trade shows, and you're at these trade shows to freaking sell, man. Like, there is nothing else that you should be doing but selling. But a lot of these different companies that are selling, they're like, wait a second, let's go talk to these guys and see what they're doing with these iPads. And then we would tell them what we were doing in the back office side and how we automated all that. And their jaws were like down to the ground, and they all asked us, can you make this for us? And in the beginning, we're like, no, we're a dog toy company. Like, we're focused on that. We're very focused. Yeah. I was like, dogs need to choose something, and we're going to do it. And so we said no in the beginning, but then we got a lot more demand. I actually did a little more market validation. I saw, like, the sorrow in these people's eyes. And, like and I was a small business, so I realized, I was like, man, we got to do this. I know what we're doing. We got to focus on what we're originally supposed to be doing, but we really need to do this. So we somehow, luckily, found a buyer for the other company. It wasn't life-changing or anything like that, but they bought it. We made a little bit of money, sort of. And then we went on to Lettuce and started this really incredible thing. And I'm so glad I did that, one, because of the outcome, but also I'm so glad I did that because I realized at the end of the day I was making dog toys. And I watched Jason Azar's talk that was on YouTube, and he had said something which I told him to this day. And by the way, Jason Azar sold his company to Intuit first, and then kind of helped get my company bought by Intuit. So it's really funny how
that works. Jason's coming this spring for an encore appearance here.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Cool. Awesome. Well, I'm going to come. I want to come watch that, actually, live. And so he had said this thing, and he's like, do you kind of feel like you were kind of, you know, put on this earth or something to do something incredible? And I was like, yes. You know, like when John asked me, like, did you always know you're going to be up here? I was like, yeah, of course. Like, I just knew I was supposed to do something incredible. And making dog toys was not that. Helping small businesses, like the core of our economy, the core of the global economy, was my passion. I was this person, there was no resources for us, and I wanted to change that. And so I made this quasi pivot into something that I was just really passionate about, and I became successful at it because I gave a shit. I loved it, and I like still love it. And now we're doing that on a bigger scale with Intuit.
Awesome. So tell us about Phone Halo. What happened to Phone Halo?
Phone Halo. So we had a great idea for finding lost phones, which, you know, everyone kept on losing, except then there was Find My iPhone kind of came out and was default on every single phone. It was free as well.
I hate Apple.
but then we were also, what we were doing is actually, the idea was it was also a device attached to your keys. And so we just said, well, you know, we want to track both phones and your keys. Well, we thought, well, what if it was more like Find My iPhone except for everything? And it really expanded the idea of what we were trying to do. So we took this pitch and we started actually selling to companies trying to do an OEM. This is where you take a large company, let's say Apple, and you say, hey, I have this great idea. Why don't you put your name on this and sell it? The iPod is a good example of a startup company doing this with Apple. So we were trying to do the same thing. We got a few deals, but the deals were just turns out to be pennies on the dollar in terms of consumer electronics margins. It sounded like a good idea at first, and then one of those things where you started down the path and seeing all the details of the contracts turned out to be really, really bad. But we didn't have the capital to manufacture on our own. And so then crowdfunding actually came along, and that's where we were actually able to build our own brand, and also in terms of technology, to actually launch this truly Find My iPhone, the personal inventory management for all your stuff, and launching that on our own, being able to do our own marketing and branding, which is a lot of fun in that. I think Christian and I were both really passionate about, and we just weren't able to do it with Cobra and these OEM deals. Mm-hmm.
Have you guys publicly announced how much you raised from crowdfunding?
We've raised $1.6 million on Indiegogo for our latest product, Tracker Bravo.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
$1.6 million.
So, I mean, at this point, you know, we've raised well over $2 million with three different products. And it's been a really fantastic journey because we're able to actually have consumers vote with their wallet and say, I love this product. Like, give me more of this. And, oh, I want this color and this feature. And, you know, I'd really love if it would do that. And so we've been able to create an audience that's really excited about what we're doing. And that's kind of the core of our company now, is this consumer base that loves what we're doing. And we just, you know, use them to kind of guide us. You know, what should our next step be? And, you know, I think that's completely changed, time to market, right? Rather than wasting a bunch of time developing something that Chris and I think is cool, we just go out and ask all the people that actually want to pay for it. And they tell us right away.
Yep, that's brilliant. We'll get the next student question.
I think it's working now. So my question to you guys, the co-founders of Tracker, sometimes when I try to come up for an idea for a company, it seems like most things have already been created, so it deters me from going towards it. But I've noticed there are a number of other Bluetooth tracking devices already on the market today, but that doesn't seem to have stopped you from creating your own and putting it on the market. How do you attempt to compete against the similar products that are already out there?
So just to paraphrase, almost everything's been done by someone at some point. So how do you enter a new market with something that isn't totally new? And the reality is almost nothing is totally new. I mean, there was order processing before, right? There was other ways to get your devices fixed. Mm-hmm. There was other ways to track. So never be discouraged by the fact that there's alternatives. There's always alternatives. Your job is to be the best alternative. But you guys want to talk specifically about some of the other tracking modalities, Bluetooth stuff that was out there?
Yeah, when we were starting up, even before when there's tons of devices, there's a competitor that launches against us every week on Indiegogo today. So we have a new entrant every week, which is pretty fun, actually. But before that, there was a bunch of different tracking devices and solutions. What we did in terms of thinking about the competitive graph, and you guys probably will all do these little quadrants, but the idea is to focus on what you can do in that market that really satisfies that core customer. So for us, in terms of how we see the differentiation in this market with all these different Bluetooth tracking devices, right? There's all these gizmos that find your keys, is that we see, hey, it's not about finding it. It's about knowing where everything is already. It's about taking that database in your head and transferring it onto your phone. So you could say, Siri, where's my keys? And Siri tells you where your keys are. Everyone else is making these tracking devices that just beep. And so if you can think about your ideas and current competition that's out there already, and what are they missing? Why are they not satisfying your need or a certain market segment, right? There's people that like light beer, and then there's people that love IPAs. Two different markets, and they're both kind of competing, but they take their own customers.
Yep, good. So let's get the mic to the next student. I think that mic might not be on, so you can you'll have a minute here to get it ready. So I have a question for everybody, but Anthony, you have sort of spearheaded getting all these iTechs. Mm-hmm. You've gotten thousands of them. team building is hugely important to every startup. It is the most important thing. It's your most important asset. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what's it like to be a young person, unproven, you don't have a long, you know, successful track record. How are you recruiting these folks?
It was awesome. So when we started it, you know, AJ was fixing phones on his campus at Cal Poly. And turns out, like, he, you know, it came from a pain point that he had. He went to Apple way too many times, paid $200 to get his phone fixed. And when you're a college student, there's you don't have much disposable income. We all know this. And so he's like, That's it. I'm going to fix this myself. And so he decided to open up his device, bought parts on Amazon, tinkered with it for an hour or so, eventually got that screen on, and learned a lot along the way. But he ended up screwing up like the volume cable or something. But he got the screen on. So, you know, as he did that, he realized a lot of his other friends were, you know, breaking their phones. And he started a budding, you know, small business on his campus. And I'm sure there's people who fix phones on the campus here, right? You got one in the crowd? Nice.
You have a competitor.
That's pretty cool.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome.
He's going to recruit you after we're done here.
We should talk. and so he started flying on campus and basically having – he had founded a fraternity on campus as well and got a lot of his pledges to put these flyers in
nice.
His campus. But so it was great. And you know, meanwhile, I was running a textbook exchange platform at UCSB at the time. It's basically I was slanging books and my business was very cyclical, right? 3 or 4 times a year could you buy and sell books. And so I looked at his business and we had been friends. By the way, you know, one of the most key things in business is to find a good co-founder because there's so many highs and lows and they're going to be with you in and out throughout all that experience and it's super important. But so when we got together and said, all right, we're looking at the smartphone market starting to take off and seeing all of our friends breaking their phones, we're like, okay, how do we scale what you're doing on your campus? So, I mean, to touch on how do you recruit iTechs, I mean, we literally started putting job listings on college campuses across the U.S. And I put 100 job listings up and started taking resumes, doing like 3-pronged interview processes with these guys, understanding exactly who they are, and selling them this opportunity. We didn't have a website. We didn't have anything. I was showing them screenshots of what our website was going to look like and basically saying, like, look, we can teach you how to do exactly what we're doing on our campus. And we ended up packaging up all this inventory for them, you know, sourced the parts from China and basically built businesses in a box. And we essentially tricked 23 people into buying these kits on college campuses. So we ship them out. It's like, great, you're iTechs now. And then eventually, you know, probably 2 weeks later, the website was up and, you know, we started marketing. And the big thing is figuring out how to support these techs and make them successful like we had done on our campuses. So it started very early. And I think, you know, as far as recruiting goes, it was, you know, we didn't have much, but you just have to work with what you have and keep iterating. You know, it wasn't like now we signed 300 iTechs a month. And we have goals of having 6,000 by the end of this year. And it's all about just starting with what you have and building out that network that's super important. And I guess, like, when you touch on how do you foster a culture and be able to recruit people like that and do it at scale, you have to have a lot of systems in place that now are onboarding, you know, to get an iTech started and selling or fixing phones. It takes 21 days on average from not knowing anything about iPhones to going through the whole training process to getting them the marketing material to getting them the apps that we've built and understand the whole system from start to finish. 21 days. It used to take a lot longer. And then we have support systems where, you know, we've built private social networks for these guys. So there's, you know, so much knowledge within these forums that has all just been curated by our iTechs. And so I think that's super important. Like, if you have a remote team, you need to find ways to build things at scale so, you know, you can rapidly get up to as many, you know, techs as you want, which is what we're working on.
Yeah, no, I love what you said, make them successful.
Yeah.
I mean, you really, especially when they're remote, they're out on their own, mm-hmm. keep them engage and you know, help them create that business on their own.
Because it could feel like you're an individual and you don't have anyone, you know, that really understands what you're doing. And so it's kind of like you're on an island, right? And if you need to be able to connect all those minds together that are doing the same thing. Yep. So
good job. So I know you had a co-founder. How did you guys recruit your first employees? And then once you go beyond your network of friends, how do you do it then?
Yeah, so for our first employee was a developer, and we were in the mindset of like, we gotta move so fast. We actually used a recruiter. And that's because, once again, like, we didn't have like a crazy big network, especially in LA. And so we said, and we also wanted someone professional because we were young, and we're like, we kind of wanted someone experienced that has done this before. And so we recruited someone through a recruiter. And then from there, you know, we used a recruiter a few more times. From there, you know, we asked every single one of our developers, you know, write down the 10 best developers you know.
Yep.
And they're like, oh, you can't get them. You can't get them. I was like, trust me, I can get them. And from there... I mean, I didn't get everyone, but from there, I like literally went down the list and I recruited some really amazing talent. And then for sales, I actually hired two people I knew from UCSB. One did mechanical engineering with me. One was a little bit older, but he was an incredible personality. And they were great for early stage because at that point, your brand is nothing and no one knows who you are. And you just want trustworthy sounds, like if you're on the phone, or trustworthy faces and people that you actually kind of like. And so these people were very likable and I hired them. And they turned out really well. And then once we got to our next stage where we needed a repeatable sales process, we started hiring more advanced salespeople from Salesforce, et cetera. And the main thing that I actually like would talk about all of this in terms of recruiting is the culture that you build. Culture, everyone talks about it like in this really vague way, but culture is hands down the most important thing, because at the end of the day, like, you're going to be going to work every day, probably for the majority of hours, if you work like we did, and you want to hang out with people that you're going to like and you're going to get along with and that you think will be successful and add something to the company. Yeah. And so the culture that we created, we didn't do too many team building type stuff. Instead, like, our culture was, because we were still like small enough, we were 15 people. Our culture was like, we're going to work our butts off. And I still think to this day, we worked crazier hours. Even at Launchpad, we were the first ones in there and we were the last ones out. And we kept that for the whole company, for all the way up to the end. And so that was our culture of like working our butts off. And when we succeeded, it was like, that was our celebration. Like, oh man, we did it. Like, this is amazing. It's starting to work. And the type of people that we hired, I learned very quickly, the best engineers, especially with engineers, the best engineers in the world, they don't care so much about salary and all these things. They want enough so that they're comfortable and the perks and all that kind of stuff, so they're like, they can focus on coding all day long. They want to work on really tough challenges that will help contribute to something greater, for the greater good. So that was our culture. Just work your butt off so we can contribute something for the greater good. And when we succeed, like, a bunch of other people succeed. And it was just like really kind of fun. And then sometimes we went and got drunk.
So we'll get to Tracker in a second. So one thing you said that really struck a chord with me, the first few people you hire is hugely important. Because what happens is when the next group of people you hire look around and they're like, well, who else is here? Mm-hmm. Just a couple days ago, I was talking to one of the very first engineers at Google. This guy was one of the first engineers. He had no intention of working at Google. No one had ever heard of Google. You know, it's just a tiny little company. I don't want to say on camera. I'll tell you off camera. And anyway, he said, I walked in there with no intention of working, and I looked around, and I knew five of the engineers, and I knew they were five of the best engineers that I knew.
Yeah.
And he said, I just saw these guys, and I'm like, I'm in.
Yeah.
Like, without really even understanding, I mean, just sort of, the rest of it didn't matter.
Yeah.
It was just, these guys are smart, these guys got it going on, I got to be part of this. And that's the person, he didn't walk into that, it was like a reception. He didn't walk into the reception expecting to want to work at this company called Goggle.
Yeah.
What did you guys do as far as recruiting? Then we'll get the next student question.
Can I say one more thing?
No, you need to be quiet. let them answer, and then you can. I had to do this in class with him, too. It just never changes. Go ahead.
Oh, man.
Well, I think that how we got our first kind of key hire was actually a senior hire. We were lucky enough to get a guy by the name Scott Hawthorne, who had previously IPO'd a company, and he actually saw us through some press and actually reached out to us, and he had a similar idea. And this is something where it was, you know, having this that idea out there, and people were already very passionate about it, and he just latched on and, you know, talked to us, and we saw his background and started to work with him casually. And it's an interesting thing just because we didn't know what we were quite doing. So it's hard to really interview someone who knows more than you, but right. We could just see from a cultural perspective that he was similar to us. We liked hanging out with him for, you know, 12, 15 hours a day, which right. is super extremely important.
Right. Yeah, 6-7 days a week.
Yeah. And so, I mean, we continue to just look first at attitude, as I think you can really see attitude and work ethic are the things that really, you know, you can't teach that. And programming languages, sales techniques, processes, you can generally teach that and get people who are working hard and have a good attitude up on any process quite rapidly. So that's kind of what we look for. Right now we use AngelList. It's an awesome service.
It's awesome.
Yep, I was hired on aptitude and attitude, with attitude being the more important of the two.
Totally.
What did you want to add?
It's just like a really everyday example. Like, if you play basketball and you go play basketball, you know, at elementary school with a bunch of random guys who aren't that good, you're gonna see that level of play, and you're gonna get to that level of play. If you want to become really good at basketball, you got to go find four or five NBA players and play with them all the time and get to that level. Mm-hmm. And so it's the same thing with engineers, same thing with everybody else. Wow, those people are really good. I want to get to that level, so I want to come work at this company.
Mm-hmm. Yep, totally agree. Let's get the next student question. Thank you.
Hi, guys. Thanks for being here. My question is, like, as young entrepreneurs, what do you think the best skill would be to have to be successful?
To be successful.
If you guys could nail down to one skill, we know it's not one skill, but which skill do you think is the most important for a young entrepreneur to succeed?
I'd
everything.
Say that's a really hard question.
Give it to us in five words or less.
Ability to understand your customer.
Was that five words?
I'll take it.
Make a product.
The ones. Everything, honestly. You have to be good at everything. But you don't have to be good at everything.
Good
Come
at
on,
learning?
You pick one. You can pick one.
One.
That's tough.
Product.
One skill? That's
not a
product.
Skill, bro.
Product? Yeah, that's not a skill. That is a skill.
It's a thing.
I believe
it's
like
a noun.
That's
a noun.
I'm not an English person, so.
Just likes to talk all day.
Yeah.
That's a tough question. It's hard to put it into one. I'd probably say just have the hustle to learn everything.
Yeah.
The willingness to learn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, curious. That, yeah. Be curious and be open to learning.
Right.
And for former students that are watching this and for students that are in this room here, I want to see you guys up on this stage.
Yeah.
What do you give them, 6 months? No. I want to see you guys up on this stage in the future. Let's give these guys a huge hand.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.